Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Todd Haynes.
Thank you.
And before we start, I just want to say what how exciting it is to see your career progress. I said Todd was one of the very first filmmakers to come to the museum almost exactly 10 years ago with Superstar, your notorious and right now out of distribution film. And you've been back a few times. And in the intervening years, made Poison, and Dottie Gets Spanked, and Safe, and now this. And it's incredible progression from little doll movie Superstar to this. So,
like your big doll movie.
I mean, it must be sort of a weird time because you wrote the film such a long time ago. You were actually, I think, almost 4 years ago when you were here with Dottie Gets Spanked. You were dressed in glam hairdo and yes, in heavy Stanislavski preparation for the film, and now it was premiered at premiered a con a while ago, but it's just hitting the theaters now. So yeah, just like sort of where is it at in your mind, you know, this project?
It's funny. There is that strange lag time in films, in you know, anyone's experience making films, whether you're working independently or in Hollywood. But yeah, it just seems like with me at times it gets to a real extreme. And it's bizarre, the whole kind of press attention to the glitter rock themes in fashion and, you know, claiming that it's going to be this trend and, you know, is very surreal to me because it just seems so much the result of a kind of media construction where a film gets put out, it has a certain theme, those themes are brought back into public attention, and, you know, related books or documentaries or, you know, stuff comes out. But it's not really as if it's coming from some deep, profound, you know, place in society that people like to claim, like, this is this need for glitter rock again.
Yeah. It's Miramax's need for glitter rock.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've talked in interviews about the films of the 70s and the sort of the films that really did come from something, like Performance and Clockwork Orange and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And these, it seems like nowadays the whole marketing mechanism is so much more evolved that it's hard for films to really get discovered and to really come out of the culture. So I'm just wondering, sort of, in making this film and evoking the films in the 70s, what you were thinking of in terms of the film culture.
It's a really interesting question. A lot of people probably read that book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, about the whole decade of 70s filmmaking. And there's a lot full of. Have you read it? Did you read the Peter Biskin?
I read long excerpts in Vanity Fair.
I really recommend it. There's a lot of gossip and there's a lot of dishing of. But one thing that's so interesting about it, just purely from a business standpoint, is the way films have changed and the way they get distributed today. And it happened with Jaws in 75 when they decided, if people remember, before 75, it was very uncommon for any major release to open, you know, citywide or nationally, open in all the theaters at once. There would usually be an exclusive engagement. And there would be this ability for a film to, you know, enter into the sort of consciousness of the public and be discussed, and people would read reviews and wait in line and talk about it. And finally, weeks and weeks later, it would open citywide. And that changed when Jaws was a major release by a studio that they decided, hey, let's just try every theater at once. And of course, they made so much money that that's been, you know, the mold ever since. And it's changed the way films get received. It changes the way the possibilities for them, for many different kinds of films, to enter into the, you know, consciousness of all of us. And so that was an interesting, just sort of purely money, you know, encouraged a change in the way films get marketed. Yeah. But Velvet Goldmine was very much the 70s is a really interesting period for a lot of different reasons to me. it's been well established how rich American filmmaking was during that period, mm-hmm. and there was a sort of window of opportunity for director-driven films to be made, largely on the mm-hmm. success of Easy Rider, mm-hmm. That went away at a certain point, and we haven't really seen anything quite like it, and I think the independent cinema scene that everyone was talking about in the 80s was sort of a hope that, wow, right. there could be some really, you know, yeah. real, you know, films with integrity coming out again from yeah. From directors. And I'm not sure that that's really been proven as true as we'd like to think, you know?
There's, all, of course, in the way that the film, this film looks at music, the music scene and glam rock, there's mm-hmm. the same kind of feeling that you're celebrating a period. And there's this double sense throughout the whole film of celebration and...
lament.
That's a good word. I was looking for a word like that. Yeah, at the same time. So yeah. how did you... that must be a hard balance to pull off, like when you're writing the film and making the film, to get those two things going on at the same time.
In a way, the lament aspect is what gave me permission to do a film this affirmative. Hmm. So in a way, and when I listened to bands like Roxy Music... I felt that there was this amazing amount of sort of longing and mm-hmm. loss, I guess, a sense of the lyrics are in past tense. Most of it is set in this sort of mournful look back to something lost, even from the very beginning, from the very first record.
Right.
The whole sentiment that it sort of stirs up is about loss and things that are no longer really available. There's a sort of mournful quality about that, which interested me a great deal. And I sort of wanted to cloak the whole film in that kind of loss, but still show you what was maybe possible for a brief time, you know, through the fans' point of view, and definitely in you know, framed by this very repressive 1984, which certainly sort of stands in for the present day.
Right. So. So what? But there is this double layer. So it's not look, the 90s looking at the 70s. You put the 80s in between. So there's, it's looking at the glam rock period from the perspective of the 80s in the present day. So I'm just wondering where that 80s layer came in. I mean,
the 80s thing was really, in a way, I wanted everything in the film to be something that came out of the 70s, even a look to the future. And there was a very interesting element in glitter rock music and themes that came out, particularly as it sort of progressed from 73 to 74 to 75, I guess, where there was this sort of doomful, you know, a sort of sense of a doomful future lurking on the horizon. Bowie's record Diamond Dogs is a good example, and it was based on the George Orwell book, and he wanted to actually do a musical or some treatment of 1984 and was refused the rights and did Diamond Dogs instead. But also even like Cabaret, which was a huge hit in 1973 and fit right into as a sort of metaphor for this decadent, you know, glitter culture and pop culture that was very celebrated at the time, but with this sort of implication that there was something very dangerous looming on the horizon as well, that this decadence couldn't really last, that it was going to explode. Yeah. And in many ways, they were right, of course. I mean, there was something that really did come around. It wasn't maybe as glamorous and flashy and apocalyptic as they were suggesting, but there was something very repressive about to happen.
And in film at the time, you could have dark endings. I mean, the endings of movies in the 70s were unsettling and disturbing, and that sort of stopped.
Yeah, absolutely.
You talk about loss before, and I'm wondering how that relates to childhood, because a lot of your films sort of deal with childhood in different ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's this section in Poison of a suburban childhood seems to, you know, maybe have to do with your own suburban childhood. Mm-hmm. Introducing dolls in your films. And to start this film with Oscar Wilde and Delivery of a Child at the beginning. So I'm just wondering if there was any specific idea.
It's funny, the autobiographic, with the exception of Dottie, really nothing in my films start from an autobiographical point. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I find incredible personal material and connections in the process of researching, writing, and making the films, but rarely is that where I begin from. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I'm almost more excited and intrigued by things that don't seemingly have any direct connection to my experience, like anorexia or something.
Right.
And then in the process of doing it, discovering something very close that I can relate to in so many different ways that I wouldn't have expected. You know?
Yeah.
And with glam rock, no, I wished I could be Arthur Stewart. I wish I could have been that English kid who, because in America it was sort of impossible to have it hit you, or virtually impossible, I think, to have it kind of sweep you unawares, you know, kind of just coming in from all sides and having that little innocent, you know, suburban mentality be assaulted by all these possibilities. In America, you kind of had to be in the know a little bit more because it wasn't quite as mainstream a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it was those films like Clockwork Orange and Performance in 2001 that were my equivalent to a glitter rock thing. Films that took me out of my suburban life and gave me, sort of demanded interaction in a way, some kind of a, they entered your imagination and they made you think, and they made you think that there was possibilities as an artist or as a thinker or as a young person.
So at the time of that glitter rock was big, how was it striking you? I mean, you were about 13 or 14 at the time.
I was even a bit younger than that, but it was. I was aware of it. I mean, and it's funny, when I did my research later, I found out, because I grew up in L.A., that there was a really massive glitter rock scene in Los Angeles. And it was typified by very young, mostly teenage girls who hung out at this club called Rodney Bingenheimer's Old English Pub on Sunset, on the Strip. And Bowie would go when he still had his long hair, and then he went when he was the Ziggy thing, and Iggy went, and they all went and hung out at this place. And it was this really raging scene in L.A. And the way it trickled down to me...
At what time was that?
This is like from 71 to 74, pretty much.
Hmm.
And the way I sensed it was more because I was still... I did go to a private high school later on where I met kids who lived all over the city, sort of artsy private school. But at that point, I was in junior high, public school, and so I was very much your neighborhood kids that you went to school with. But still, there were these girls that were like these very precocious girls that, you know, in the early 70s in America, people were into hippies. And, you know, you couldn't buy a new pair of blue jeans without taking them into the backyard and running them over in the car 20 times and putting them in the swimming pool for a week and then washing them 50,000 times before you dare wear them to school. Because if they looked new, you were like... so uncool. All of a sudden, these girls were wearing bright red nail polish, new shiny clothes, lipstick, like glossy, flavored lipsticks, you know, and being very banal, very like, oh yeah, Bowie, oh, you know, bi. Bowie's bi. And then you're like, bi. And so it was sort of, and as I learned a bit more about what that was all about, it was sort of... a dangerous kind of something I couldn't quite meet, you know. I felt like I had to put it aside and go, I'm going to get back to this later, you know. Like you do, I think, when you're disturbed by things when you're young.
So the boundary, I mean, one thing that the film, what the film really explores is that the boundary crossing was much more... bizarre than it is today. There's a sense. One thing that I think the film is doing is sort of looking at the questioning the politically correct definitions of gay, and that there's an idea today that there's more gay culture overtly in our culture, but that the definitions are also more rigid at the same time today.
Yeah.
So
more organized around traditional notions of identity, politics, I guess, as people have termed it. And what was pretty amazing to me, or radical to me, in a lot of interesting ways about the sexual climate in this period, is that it was so bent on breaking down the neat little categories that we love as a culture.
Mm-hmm.
Straight, gay, you know, male, female. It was really interested in blurring those lines, and that's far more dangerous to either side.
So for David Bowie to come out and say, I'm gay, but then to be calling his parents and assuring him that he's not really gay.
I mean, you'll hear every possible story about Bowie's, coming out and all of that. But but you know, it's pretty well documented that he explored, like most people did at that time. But I've spoken to people who, you know, like Mick Rock, the photographer, who did all the Bowie record covers, and Lou Reed, and you know, he was the main man photographer with their company and traveled with them. And he, you know, he was this, probably at any other point in history, just this straight, nice, straight guy, you know, but who just so was sucked into this world. And I think it took him about 20 years to begin to be able to really talk about what happened, because it was a complete and total, you know, trip, you know, and people were really going for it and trying drugs and trying sexual experiments. And, you know, and even if you weren't, you pretended that you were. You made it look like you were.
This will sound like a really sort of simplistic question, but where in all the your thinking now about glam rock, where did it come from? Because it's so different than everything in rock sort of leading up to it was, you know, towards expressing yourself and being natural and being and so this total artifice, which you relate to Oscar Wilde and relate to British theatrical traditions, like where did it come from? Like how did it erupt? Because it was so,
I mean, it's clear that there were traces of it in rock and roll from Elvis, Little Richard, the Kinks, the Stones. You know, there were examples of androgyny definitely throughout all of those different periods, but never had it become so overt, so completely in your face before. And I think never had the whole idea of putting on a show been so much the point of the, what they really wanted to put, but with a kind of, you know, with an element of attack and critique to the 60s culture and all of its assumptions. So it came from many different things. I think Warhol is a huge influence you can't underestimate, you know, for both the way that, you know, he produced the Velvet Underground, who became a key influence to people like Bowie and to Brian Ferry and Roxy Music, but the whole sensibility that put out there, that one, you know, you could become a star by dressing the part and performing, and you could recreate the star system in some dinky loft in, you know, in New York, and it would be this ability to sort of, you know, replicate that whole process, but deconstruct it at the same time.
Yeah, there was a lot of fascination with early Hollywood. I mean, we see the Gene Harlow. Picture is an homage to that. But,
exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't think it could have happened, as you've already suggested, you know, without, it couldn't have happened anywhere but in England, and it couldn't have happened without that tradition, that really strange.
But since you mentioned Warhol, I have to ask you about Jack Smith, which is another, because now there's discussion on the internet in the experimental film group discussion about your film. And
oh, really? And I have to see this.
And Jack Smith and Flaming, so obviously Jack Ferry, the relationship of Jack Ferry to Jack Smith.
No, Jack Smith, Jack Ferry is named after Jack Smith.
Okay.
And was sort of meant to be that kind of character, like Jack Smith was, who was this sort of, almost like a Little Richard, like someone where it was going to happen, no matter where this person, you know, found himself living, whatever city, whatever era, he would become this thing, this bizarre collection of you know, costumes and illusions, and the fact that Little Richard erupted in, you know, Alabama in the era that he did is incomprehensible in a way. There was some incredible force inside that was just going to happen.
Yeah. You know?
And I just wanted not to get into authenticity too much here, but but to distinguish that from what the Brian Slade character represents, which is this much more savvy ability to sort of sense what's going on in the zeitgeist and pull from it. And maybe these kinds of Jack Smiths and Jack Ferries and wouldn't ever come to light. And in many ways, Jack Smith didn't. You know, he remains a very obscure, peripheral figure, although he's a lot of people now realize how important he was, but he didn't make the impact that he may have liked to have made.
The film, what's interesting in the film is the there's a lot of references to real people, and there's a lot of fiction, and I mean, obviously the big reference is David Bowie, but the film is not about David Bowie, and Bowie's music isn't in it. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about how does Bowie play into this?
It is about Bowie. I mean, it's about, I can't not say that Bowie is such a huge, he's the most influential figure in that whole period, as far as I'm concerned. And maybe even beyond the music that he produced, the images that he created are the ones that I think sum up you know, the period the most powerfully. Mm-hmm. And those images affected everybody around mm-hmm. him, and people copied him, you know. And he copied them. I mean, it was a kind of free system of you know, equal opportunity stealing for everybody, which he was extremely articulate about. There was no hiding it. He called himself a human Xerox machine, you know, in the early 70s. And what was funny about Bowie and amazing about him, and what made me know that I could only approach this film as a fiction, is that the way in which he constructed himself many times over, and then literally, you know, a la Warhol, there was this production of a play called Pork that came out in 1970 and played in New York and in London. And it was a second generation group of Warhol actors. And it was this outrageous play based on the, you know, phone conversations Warhol would have about parties that he had attended the night before that Bridget Polk would transcribe before the diaries. Mm. And they turned it into this play. Mm. And it had nudity and sex and, you know, I think it was like a white, so 1970, like a white set, all white with a white plastic table and a big chocolate cake on the table. And that was it. And then like a lot of nudity and, you know, Cherry Vanilla was in it. And she's always just popping her top off and, you know, like jumping into the cake and rubbing it. You know, it's just all that kind of stuff. Bowie and Angela saw it in 1970 and were blown away. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, this is New York. This is really edgy. and the Pork cast had heard about Bowie, this guy who wears a dress, and they thought, wow, he's going to be great. So they all met up. And, of course, Bowie was just still in his sort of floppy hat, long hair, kind of hippie mode, which they were so uninto. Mm-hmm. Angela was wild and fantastic and crazy, and they had all already plucked all their eyebrows and drawn them back on, hot, you know, like 1930s style, dyed their hair, were wearing platform shoes and glitter in like 1970. Mm. Next time they saw Bowie, he had shaved his eyebrows, dyed his hair, put on platform shoes. Right. And when they set up this main man studio, when Bowie changed managers and got Tony DeFries, who Eddie Izzard is sort of doing a, you know, tribute to. the whole idea was, let's literally, as the film suggests, in much broader terms, but not that much more broad, let's put on a show. They hired the entire cast of Pork to be Bowie's entire company, Main Man. Hmm. So they became the vice president of Main Man, the press attaché, the, you know, tour director. And these people had never done any of this stuff before. They were just these crazy New York nuts.
Yeah.
And they performed Bowie's success to the world. Hmm. And it worked. And they did everything that the film, you know, coyly or not so coyly suggests, like play it like you're a star. Buy two of everything, the best of everything. Put it on RCA Credit. So Credit was just racked up. Yeah. They would buy out huge houses that he had no business thinking he could fill, and they papered them and filled them with people. And, you know, they just really played it to the hilt. So the ways in which real life and fiction making, and the way that at this particular time in the music industry that was very susceptible to hype in ways that, because it was moving sort of from a cottage industry in the 60s to what would eventually become a mega corporate industry in the late 70s. And at this particular point, it was susceptible to these kinds of, you know, machinations and of public points of view, like probably in no other time. And they were just right, ready, poised for that, take advantage of that.
What was the production of this film like for you? Because you're it's so much about spectacle, it has to be big and spectacular. And I've rarely talk to directors about what your budget is and things like that. But the fact that it's sort of been out in the press that you had a very limited budget, $7 million to make this, and never having done anything on this scale and working with that kind of budget, what was it like producing this? Unpleasant memories.
No, it was really, really tough. Christine Dashon's book, actually, if people have heard about it,
Shooting to Kill,
and it has some of her journals from the shoot, and they're really painful for me to read, because they bring it all back. It was the hardest thing I've ever set out to do. And it were not for the fact that I really did surround myself with fantastic people, you know, great actors who I loved working with, and I've become good friends with a lot of them, and amazing designers and technicians, and a really great crew in London. I don't know how I would have gotten through it, you know. And Christine and I didn't really have fun ever when we were shooting it, but they all did. And I think we made it possible for them to have fun. Christian yeah. Bale said at the end, he was like, you know, Todd, I've never worked on a film before where, you know, I always know that there's all that bullshit going on with the production in any movie, no matter what. But I've never not felt it before, which I couldn't believe. I mean, I just felt like, he's got to be kidding me. Because we were, you know, new, and I didn't particularly have the same experience. But I'm just glad that was true for a lot of the actors.
There's such a sense of structure to it, which, I mean, we were talking about before, which I... once you've seen the film a few times, you see how intricate it is.
Right.
But you also want it to have the feeling of freedom.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering sort of what the writing process was like, and how, you know, how you found the structure to it. I mean,
it was tough. It was a lot of distillation, I guess, of a lot of ideas, trying to get them down to the purest sort of condensation of a lot of, you know, almost so that things became almost archetypal events in the classic rock and roll movie in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, the story is kind of generic, and it was never intended to be much more than that. And it really was meant to operate much more at the level of spectacle and music, and, you know, like an opera or like a musical.
Yeah.
And which you don't really go to for story per se. Maybe operas you do, but musicals, the stories are sort of symbolic of other things, and the emotion is found more through the surrounding elements, the color and music and you know, spectacle. I'm not sure. I think it may be a curse to the film as well. I know a lot of reviewers are like, you know, it seems so disorganized and so all over the place when you see it on a first viewing, and many people who see it a second time really do see that it's actually very, very planned out. And it was very hard while we were shooting. We were running behind. Financiers were kind of not being horrible, but slightly, well, they probably were to Christine, and she was protecting me from it. But they were saying, he's got to cut scenes. And I really couldn't, and I wanted to cut scenes. I mean, I wanted to lighten the load for myself more than anything. But I couldn't. Everything had some narrative piece of information that was going to connect to something else.
Yeah.
It was this real, like, jigsaw puzzle that was very pre-planned. And it was very hard to, like, change that in midstream. It was impossible. So we really shot the script. And when you see, if you read the script, it's available outside of it. It's weird how close it is to the film. I think that's unusual for most films. It's very, very, very close.
Ewan McGregor is so great in the movie, but it wasn't, it was sort of, might have seemed like an odd choice in the beginning to cast a British actor in this, like, such an essentially American role.
I know.
So just talk about sort of casting him, and then he's a pretty good musician. Performer.
He really is. I saw Trainspotting, and I was really blown away by that performance. And I couldn't think of an American actor in his generation who had the same kind of energy. There's this, you know, there's some great young actors, male actors in America, but there's this sort of tradition now that's kind of a, maybe a James Dean throwback of the sort of Johnny Depp kind of brooding, introspective, kind of like heavy, feet on the ground kind of thing. And I wanted Kurt Weill to be this volatile character who could surprise you, who could just leap in the air suddenly, sort of flame-like kind of quality. And I just couldn't think of any. I thought of like a young Sean Penn or something, but that I couldn't think of a real parallel today. So he was the only actor going into the process of casting that I actually had a real firm feeling that it was going to work with him. I went after him pretty early. And I was really pleased with it. All the actors were playing some hybrid. No one was really themselves.
What they were,
I mean, Johnny, who's Irish, was playing English. Tony's Australian, was playing English and American. And Ewan was Scottish, playing American. And Christian was English, but playing Mancunian, his perfect Manchester accent. But so everyone was faking it.
Do you have a sense, I mean, have you been able to see the film with enough audiences to get a sense? I'm curious of how this film might play to teen audiences or younger audiences. I mean,
yeah, that's what I really wanted it to, like, somehow, you know, despite all of its ideas and its, you know, poetic, you know, liberties and all of that, that it somehow could, because those movies, again, going back to that, those films from the late 60s, early 70s, which came out of drug culture, like Performance, was probably the one I paid the most attention to while I was making this film. they're esoteric. They're kind of like, you know, they're purposefully vague, and the stories are, they don't always hold together, yeah. You know, but you don't care. You're in it for something much more trippy and kind of self-revelatory, and, you know, something that's going to, you're going to learn something about who you are in the process of watching these films. And like a drug experience, I guess, which is what these films really did come from. And that's the level. And yet those kinds of films don't get made today. Yeah. I just can't think of anything quite like that that kids can sort of obsess over, you know,
right.
And like I did, and play, you know, see it over and over again, and play the soundtrack with your friends and analyze it, you know.
Right.
That's what I really hoped could happen.
I want to give the audience a chance to ask questions if anybody wants to jump in and ask about this film or any of Todd's other work. Right here.
Yeah, I've got a question. You mentioned that most of your films, except for Todd, are not really autobiographical, so the childhood aspect. And I noticed kind of a commonality with Safe Today and with Velvet Underground, that the protagonist is Julianne Moore in Safe and Christian Bale in
Velvet
Underground are kind of...
Goldmine.
It's
easy to do that.
Kind of untouched. The same way that the other characters are. The other characters, there's the scene in Safe where Moore, where they're sitting around and Peter is asking, why are you ill? And one person apparently, you know, was abused as a child or wounded as a child. One was, blames herself for a tragedy. And then in here, you got Jack Ferry's beaten up by kids, discovers his, you know, away from the mask.
Brian stays.
Yeah, observes the two old men having sex. And yet the protagonists are kind of, they come along at this from another angle. And I'm wondering if that's intentional, if that reflects that your upbringing isn't maybe as dramatic as the supporting characters.
That's really interesting. I hadn't seen, it's true, Carol and Arthur are these sort of observers in a way, trying to do the right thing and fit in the right way. You know, obviously Arthur's.
He does
world.
Get his share of torture though from his parents. So.
Yeah.
But you're drawing it to an autobiographical question. Let me think.
If there's an intent, if that's intentional or not.
No, I guess it's not, because it's not something I thought. I mean, I really do see the two films as the opposite sides of a coin, in that they are both very much about questions of identity, but one obviously Safe, which, you know, gives you no real sort of, you know, gives you the wrong answers to what we're supposed to be, you know, in the world, and Velvet Goldmine offers this little brief moment of radical alternatives, perhaps, to what the world usually, you know, favors. But yeah, I hadn't really, I mean, there's really interesting, it's interesting. I have to think about it more. But I'm not sure how it relates to me personally. I think the directors are observers, and that's probably innate to us.
Okay, down here.
It's obviously a sexual thing, but for me, I was just listening recently to the 66 bootleg tapes of Dylan. And,
right.
As one reference, and listening to the audience, like, on Judas and get so upset at his electrification, and then watching your film, which now I've seen twice, and the whole Bowie thing meant a lot to me when I was growing up. And to my perception, I don't see that kind of passion for music. Like, it might just be my perception. I'm just wondering if you see that or what you think of these days.
Yeah. Oh, today.
Nobody seems like I can't imagine anybody screaming if Madonna decided to. Come out playing swing or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I hate contributing to something that's in me, an instinct that's in me, which is a bit of a passant, I guess, someone who, you know, does look back a lot and what, because when you do think about the late 60s, early 70s, and the climate of just even in the most generic sense, in the most mainstream sense, the way in which we were sort of forced to question authority and have some contempt for, you know, power and money and people who just want to make it in the world. I mean, those ideas are so unbelievably foreign to the contemporary you know, world that we're in now, it is shocking to me how really that wasn't that long ago. But it feels like so far away when you really get back to the mindset. You know, you just watch a show like Laugh-In, which was a big, popular mainstream hit on television, and the implicit political ideas, you know, in that show. Or it's interesting to watch Saturday Night Live over the years, the way humor has political sort of focus or undercurrent that seems purposeful. You know, the earliest Saturday Night Live seemed to be the most, you know, targeted to stuff that was going on in the world. And then you get to different other generations of it, and they're just going through the same motions and doing the same kinds of skits, but there's no point. There's no real target, and the humor is weak and silly and sort of gimmicky, you know? So, yeah, I keep thinking, no, there's... I don't want to, like, reject what's going on today for, you know, without really examining it closely. It's a very different world that we're in, and there are a lot of... I do think young people in certain cities, and there's a great progressiveness and openness to ideas that wasn't possible when I was young. But I think they don't always know what to do with that. There's not really a place to direct it, you know? Everything was like a protest when I was growing up and in college. What, you know, any problem, you just go out and start protesting. And people don't have any, not that that was always, you know, practical and good, but yeah, it's very different.
Hmm. Okay, right there?
I wonder if this is accidental or not, but the Kurt Wilde character, at times he looked like Kurt Cobain. And my friend and I were just talking about that, and that's sort of like what you're saying about the hybrids and how these people come out from, you know, various parts of the country.
Yeah.
It's interesting that there he is in the film almost, even though it's not about his music or anything, but it was really striking.
It's really funny. For being such a control freak that I am, that, I have to confess, was absolutely and totally accidental. And Ewan himself didn't even realize it. You know, he just happened, his physical features with that wig on just looked so much like Kurt Cobain. Yeah. I mean, that wasn't something that he planned at all. He was really thinking of Iggy and Lou and the historically, you know, useful people to look to. But it really wasn't even something we picked up on set. It was something in the editing room. Jim and I are like, the only time he brought it up is when we were having one of our earliest discussions about the film. He hadn't even read the script yet, and we were in London having coffee, and he said, you know, actually, once I was mistaken for Kurt Cobain. And you can't, when Ewan's not like skinny, like lost a little weight and has his normal hair, you don't see it. It just doesn't, I was like, huh, I don't really see that. And he said he was at some rave once, and I think it was after Kurt Cobain had died, and girls who were tripping were coming over a mountaintop, and they saw Ewan, and one girl was like, oh my God. And Ewan went. But that, and then it went out of my head from that point on. It's very funny. I don't mind it for the reasons that you said, because it does sort of, yeah. Yeah. He's named after Kurt Davis, a friend of Jim Lyons, my co-story writer, who is this great sort of punk, gay punk guy who died and who was great spirit. But
okay, right there.
The whole David Bowie thing is interesting. Even the film is named after a David Bowie song, right?
Yeah.
In the bedroom scene, when there's photos on the wall of all the glam rock people, I'm not sure if Roy Wood there was in a sort of slate himself. There's no David Bowie pitch. Is that
It was tricky to know what kind of you know, real life real characters to put into background scenes, because you know we were reconstructing it all. It was meant to be like a parallel universe to the real universe, or like a dream that you have where all of the real things are mixed up and out of place, proper place. So we were, you obviously know all those bands well, which people in England will know better than in America. But and again, it's a quick shot where we just sort of pan by. So I didn't want, you know, I didn't want to draw a huge amount of attention to which of the peripheral bands would play. But again, we picked people from the more mainstream side of the glitter scene. Like, we didn't put pictures of Brian Ferry in or any of the sort of art school tradition that the film is really focused on. we chose to do the more, you know, glitzy ones. But yeah, Elton John's in the magazine, you know. So yeah, it's one of those little.
Okay, over here.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the decision to make a fiction film on this real period, and if there's any sense of how you would address people who may feel something's missing, who are also excited by that period, who want to get to the real stories or rumors or figures.
To me, the whole, tradition of trying to get to the real truth, particularly when we tell movies about famous people, is very suspect and wrought with all kinds of contradictions. And yet they're fun. We all like it, and we sort of don't care. You know, there's a real pleasure in just watching it. Oh, that's Tina Turner. That's what happened, you know? And in a way, the glitter rock people, while being so dismissed afterwards for this kind of attitude, were ultimately maybe a few steps ahead of that conundrum, you know, in that they were acknowledging the artifice from the outset and with a great deal of wit and irony and pleasure in what was inherently fake. Not just about standing up, the fact that I'm up here in a spotlight in glitter clothes and you're down there in the dark watching me, but there's a huge difference there. But I think at levels of identity by saying that identity is fake and that we dress up every day into who we are. And these artists are going to take it to such a degree that they're going to change who they are every year. It's going to be Ziggy Stardust and then Aladdin Sane and then Thin White Duke and Halloween Jack and, you know, endless succession of characters that fans were invited to impersonate and mirror themselves with and change who they were, you know, accordingly. And when you're a young person and everything is unstable and every minute seems like, you know, a year, that to me was a really healthy offering, something that really was liberating and like, yeah, it's all right. Changes was the word. There wasn't this whole idea of like finding who you are and sticking to it and being true to that was being questioned in a really brilliant
and
way.
This what you're describing is what all your films are, as different as all your films are, that's what all of them are really about. And of course, the ultimate film that questions identity is Citizen Kane, which is such a structuring idea for your films. I'm wondering how, I guess two different questions. One is how the Citizen Kane thing came in. And then it seems like what glam rock is about is so much about what your whole approach to filmmaking is about. That's maybe too big a question.
Well, but no, I think in many ways, except that, as I said earlier, I'm often more comfortable taking a critical perspective to issues in the world as I see it, and not, you know, even in a film like Poison, which, you know, draws from Genet so heavily, I always had a real, like, ooh, I can't give Genet to the world.
Right.
I can't do that. It's not possible. All I can do is, you know, quote from him, but interpret it solely through my eyes as an American filmmaker in the early 90s, doing a treatment of that work. But more talking about what in America right now makes that work pertinent, or those issues pertinent, what problems or constraints or restrictions make that necessary to think about. And then you can think about it yourself and find your own solution. But yeah, glam rock, the Velvet Goldmine film is probably the one that does you know, actually give you a little taste of something different, of a different kind of pleasure that, you know, that then it's just, there's a reservoir around it of loss and inaccessibility. But yeah, I think, you know, I know with people who bring a lot of history and memories and associations to this period, this can be a frustrating film to watch, especially the first time, where you're sitting there like, wait a minute, that isn't, you know, it's like, it's all mixed up. But I just think to really appreciate and embrace what they were doing, you have to acknowledge it's complete liberation from notions of truth and realness and what really happened. I also think we never know what really happens behind closed doors with famous people. We want to know. What we do know, and some of them give you no clues, they shut the door, that's it. And we sit there going, oh man, what's going on? But these guys flirted with their audience and put out so many clues and played their characters off stage and on stage. And there's pictures of Bowie kissing Lou Reed and you know, Mick Jagger, and, you know, there's all of this stuff circulating. And to me, that gets out into the world. That's real. That's like stuff kids take home and look at and think about and fantasize, and it triggers real, you know, responses, physical, emotional. To me, that's more real than anything that we could ever know about famous people, and maybe more interesting. And these artists were actively engaged in, you know, putting that stuff out there. So.
Okay, down here. Go ahead.
I actually had two questions. One is that I wonder if how you exist seems to be not almost not a lonely experience, but where there's not music in the film. Mm-hmm. And if the music came before the structure of the images, or how that worked, if they simultaneously.
Hmm. Do people hear that question in the back?
No.
There's so much music throughout the film. Did the images come from the music? Was the music there first, and that suggested the images?
Yeah, to a large degree, the music was there in the writing stage. And whole scenes would be written almost verse by verse, paralleling a certain song, sort of like it was a musical in many ways. And it was interesting at times, like the song Sweet Thing by David Bowie I wanted to use it in the rooftop scene at the end. And the dialogue was written in and around the verses. And then we couldn't use the song. And in this case, I just lifted the song out and was left with this structure. And it worked really well without the music, I think. I think I like it more. I think the music maybe underscores the points more than they need to be made. So that was an exception to the rule. But for the most part, the music was there from the beginning.
If you make an equation between the transformation from Slade to the Stone character with like Ziggy Stardust to Let's Dance,
would I?
If like Bowie's transformation,
I never it never occurred to me until now. It's funny that you say that. No, of course. I mean, you know, it was grotesque what happened to many of the key glitter figures in the 80s. But I mean that, not to just, you know, shy away from focusing it onto Bowie, but in a way no one was exempt from that, or very few people were, and actually Bowie's very critical about that period now. He's really dismissive of it, which is interesting because it is his most, you know, financially successful period. But it was a lot of horrible things happening.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.